Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Actually, you can go over to 1517.org and you can go over to the Christ Hold Fast section because that's where it is now. It's over there at one site. You can go over there to the Chad Bird section. That's where Chad stuff is. You're probably like me and you probably just, you know, click on links to articles, you know, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. And you probably don't, you know, just peruse sites. But if you haven't went over there and perused and kind of navigated through the new site, you should do it because there's a lot of cool stuff over there. Everything's living in one spot. And yeah, just go over to 1517.org. ChadBird.com will take you there. ChristHoldFast.org will take you there too. But you'll check out all the new stuff we got going on over there. While you're over there, you can register for the Here We Still Stand conference if you haven't done it. I think there's about 30 tickets left for you if you want to go, so that's not very many. You can get $25 off that ticket for being a podcast listener if you enter the code PNET19 at checkout. So you can go there. Hey, you can come to the podcast pre-conference. You're listening to this podcast. You can come see us record this podcast live. You can watch the Thinking Fellows and Banned Books. You can go to the podcast pre-conference. It's great. And you can do that while you're over there as well. Chad, what's going on, man?
I just was thinking when you were talking, man, is there any aspect of theology we don't have covered? We got it all, right?
All of it.
Yeah, all of it. Whether it's in a podcast or article or class or anything, it's all there.
Yeah, man. Now it's a pretty good library of stuff we got going on over there.
Yeah. I do hear from a lot of people who use the site for, I mean, sometimes it's for just themselves or their families or their churches. You know, so I don't know. It's great to know that the resources are being used in all sorts of different situations, which, of course, is why they're there, right?
It's why we do what we do. Yeah, I mean, it's really nice to be able. I mean, this happens a lot of times. We'll get emails and stuff from people saying, "Hey, do you have anything on blank?" You know, or they'll ask a question. "Hey, I was wondering, could you answer this question about blank?" And it used to be that I would have to sit down if I wanted to answer it. And we get a lot of that kind of stuff. We get a lot of emails. It would take, you know, I had to set a day aside and answer emails if I wanted to give people answers, which of course you do, but it's time consuming. It's a lot easier now because we have so much material now that we've probably done something on it. And so I can go over there and find something that's one of us has written or a video or a podcast on that thing. So yeah, we talk about that right here, you know, and just send a link, which is really nice.
Yeah. I've done the same thing. I mean, it's time saving, but also, you know, usually an article is able to develop an answer a little bit more fully than we can in a brief email. So I find myself doing that quite a bit, either with emails, with questions that get sent to me, or even on social media, somebody asks a question, you say, well, yeah, we talk about this here. It's a treasure trove. A lot of good stuff there for everybody.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure what we're going to talk about today is going to be something that people have a lot of questions about.
Yeah. So far, knock on wood, so far, I have never been emailed a question about Deuteronomy 22:13 and following. But hey, you never know. Today might just be the day. So if anybody asked me, I could say, you know what? We talked about that in episode whatever this is. Of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. So give it a listen. What we're talking about, joking about, is the second half of Deuteronomy 22. If you were with us last time, which I hope you were, then you know that we've talked about some rather strange stuff, laws and customs and whatnot, having to do with all sorts of things. Well, a little bit of that is going to continue here in the next couple chapters. So I'm going to summarize quite a bit here of 13 through 30. That's the second half of Deuteronomy chapter 22. So basically what this is talking about is all sorts of questions related to sexual activity. So the first issue here is, so you got a couple and they just got married, and the husband turns out he doesn't like his wife, and he accuses her of not being a virgin on their wedding night. And he starts like spreading this story. I don't want to call it a fact. I want to call it a rumor. But anyway, he starts telling people about this, publicly defaming her, is what verse 14 says. look, I took this woman, and when I married her, I didn't find her a virgin. So there is a couple of different ways this could fall out. I mean, one is that the parents, this is going to sound really strange to us, but the parents can like bring out evidence of her virginity. And it sounds strange to us, but I've been doing a little bit of research this week, and evidently this is not like unheard of in a lot of different cultures around the world, where there's a garment, maybe it's the sheet, maybe it's a special kind of garment, and it's underneath the woman on the wedding night, and when the hymen is broken and blood is there, this is actually kept as evidence of her virginity on her wedding night. So this was it, of course. That is, unless you're listening from one of those cultures, that is going to sound rather strange to you, but that's what is being talked about here. Verse 17 talks about spreading the garment before the elders of the city. And the garment they're talking about is the garment that has this proof of her virginity on there. So this was evidently a custom, at least in parts of Israel's history. So anyway, if the guy makes this accusation and, the parents bring this out and say, basically, he's lying. He's defaming our daughter. Then the guy, he's gonna suffer for what he's done. First of all, he's gonna get publicly chastised, and he's gonna be fined 100 shekels of silver. And then he was trying to get out of the marriage, evidently, but he can't. So they're stuck. They're stuck together. I have to feel sorry for his wife. But anyway, that's one situation that could happen. The other situation is going to sound even more extreme to us, and that is if the charge is true and the girl was not a virgin, she is stoned to death. The listeners are thinking, good grief. You know, I was thinking about this and some of the other stuff there in this chapter about, and not just this chapter, but a lot of different sections of Deuteronomy. Doesn't it seem to you like people are getting put to death an awful lot for a whole lot of things? I mean, there's just like, you do this, you're going to die. You do that, you're going to die. There's a whole lot of death penalties here. But when you look at the actual history of Israel, and not just the history, but like specific examples, it doesn't seem like this law was followed to a T in a lot of different situations.
Dude, you almost never see this stuff happen. I mean, even in Jesus' day, when they catch the woman in adultery and they're like, let's stone her.
Yeah, I was going to bring up that example.
Yeah, I mean... They're trying to trap Jesus,
right?
Because they all get the stones, and Jesus is like, you know, writing in the dirt, and you know, he's out sin, cast the first stone, and they all throw the rocks down. Like, dang it, that was a good response. But if they were actually intent on doing it,
they just done it.
Like, because they're like, it doesn't matter if I have sin, I didn't do this sin, and this is the punishment for this sin. They were wanting him to either let her off, which makes him not care about the law, or be like, yeah, go ahead, which makes him heartless.
Right.
That's what they wanted. And so, yeah, I mean, all of these laws, there's a million ways to die in Israel, and you just don't see it happen that often. You see people, because I'll tell you this, if you think there was just like zero people who weren't virgins on their wedding night, I mean, I think that you're probably just insane. And I do think this is the other thing to point out, not that this makes the punishment any less severe, but I think some people think this is all about purity. And one thing you didn't mention is also, I mean, it seems to me that like what the big issue here is the lying. If you just say, look, I'm not a virgin, they don't take you out and stone you. If a woman if she's honest about it, that you don't get stoned. It's if you went into a relationship claiming to be a virgin, and then it's found out that you're not, that's when you get stoned. Likewise, if this guy is found to be lying, the lie is the problem, lying about you not being a virgin, then he has to pay all this money, and it says here that the elders of the city shall take that man and beat him. So, like, you're gonna get beat. You're gonna pay you're gonna pay 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father. So you gotta pay a fine. You gotta get out in public and just get the tar beat out of you. And it seems to me that in both of these instances, the thing that they don't like is the deceit.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, there obviously you're like, well, is it always stoning if you lie? Well, no, this is different than that. So that does have something to do with purity and this sort of thing. But if this isn't just a, if it is found out that you are not a virgin, you get stoned. We stone all people who aren't virgins. That's not the law. This test seems pretty easy to fake. Because mom and dad have this, you know, this sheet or whatever. Like, all you need is a bloody sheet. I mean, I can...
It's pretty easy to pull off.
Give me 15 minutes. I'll get you a bloody sheet.
Yeah.
I mean, if you knew, if your daughter was like, look, I told him I'm a virgin. I'm not a virgin. You could have this thing ready to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be very easy to get around this law. Which it probably happened too. You know, another thing just to keep in mind about this is there's like no law. Okay. Say she does lie about her virginity. And, the new husband finds out. It doesn't say he has to do this. You know, she can say like, all right, yeah, you know, I've been with a guy before. He's like, I forgive you. And everything's good. Right?
Yeah.
So it's not as if this is describing a situation that has to happen every single time, in other words.
And I think that's why we see it happen basically never.
Right. Yeah. Another situation, I mean, that's like this, you think of Joseph and Mary, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which actually fits with something later in the chapter, but they're engaged, which in Jewish law is the equivalent legally of marriage. And so when he finds out she's pregnant, of course he thinks she's been with another man, but he doesn't. Doesn't reveal this. He just divorces her, decides he's going to divorce her quietly. And was Joseph breaking the law? Well, no, I think he was acting in love, and love is the fulfillment of the law. So
yeah. Yeah, I think ultimately what you have here is that, yeah, purity is obviously something that there's a high emphasis placed on. There's also something that God really doesn't want going on is deceiving people. He doesn't want deception going on within the people. And he doesn't want, and we see this over and over again, he doesn't want people lying about other people either. This isn't, I don't think it's as much about the purity. The purity was a big thing to the people, obviously. And it's not that it's not nothing to God either. But it's, like you said, this isn't a punishment for that. It's for the lying, because you don't have to do this if you find out someone's not a virgin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting section. the rest of the chapter deals with some other situations that have to do with sex as well. So you've got adultery discussed in verse 22, and if man's found lying with a married woman, then they're both put to death. And then you have a situation where you have a girl who's a virgin and she's engaged to another man. This is what I was talking about earlier in connection with Mary. And so there's a couple different situations here. So she's a virgin, she's engaged, and what if a man forces himself on her? What if he rapes her? And the example that she used is she's in the field and she cries out, but nobody can hear her. Well, then she's innocent, but the guy, of course, is guilty. He's guilty of rape. And so it equates rape with murder in a sense, because verse 26 says that just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this particular case. So it equates this attack upon another person, in one case murder and in one case rape. And the rapist is also guilty of is to be sentenced to death. But then you have a situation, kind of wraps up the chapter, where a guy and a girl, they hook up, they have sex, and then, but I mean, it was both like it was a consensual relationship, and they're found out. Well, in that particular case, then the guy has to marry the girl, but he has to pay her father the dowry, basically 50 shekels of silver, and then she becomes his wife. All sorts of different sexual situations going on here. And then to wrap up everything in the chapter, we have a verse that is going to sound really weird, but hopefully I can explain it in a way where you might say, you know what, I guess I could see that happening. Verse 30 says, a man shall not take his father's wife so that he shall not uncover his father's skirt. We might think, come on, you really have to prohibit that. Okay, but so I'm reading a Jewish commentary on Deuteronomy, and he actually explained a situation where, knowing human nature, you'd be like, Oh yeah, I guess so. So a lot of men were married two or three times. So maybe they were married and they had some children with their first wife, and then she died, and so he remarried, and then maybe had some children with his second wife, and she died, and he married a third time. And this is not unusual, even in more recent times, right? Because childbirth, of course, is a very dangerous activity. A very, for women, a lot of things can happen in childbirth. So think about this. You got a man who's now on his third wife. His first two wives died, but he had children with his very first wife, and those children have grown up. And now he remarries, say, a third time. There's a very good chance that his oldest children, say his oldest son, is of the same age or even older than the third wife that the man marries.
Yeah, because at this time you're trying to have as many children as possible,
Yeah.
and so you're probably marrying down
Yeah,
every time.
exactly. Yeah, I mean, it was typical for no matter what the age of the man to marry a woman who is just of the marrying age. She's just had her first period, and so what? She's what, 15, 16, maybe? You think about this. So maybe the guy's oldest son is 17, 18, 19 years old, and his stepmom is 16. Well, you can see how that kind of situation would be a possible temptation, and that's why you have verse 30.
Well, it's also, I mean, they don't even have to die. I mean, we've talked about this last week a little bit, but also people just taking multiple wives is not uncommon.
Yeah, that's true. In a polygamous household, the same thing could be happening. So, yeah, it's one of those verses when you read it on the surface, you're like, oh yeah, okay, thanks. It's like those verses that forbid us from eating buzzards or something, like it's going to happen. But it's a very realistic scenario in this particular culture. Okay, enough about sex. We'll move on to 23. We got some more material coming up here. So this first, let's see, about the first eight verses or so is delineating who and who cannot be part of the assembly. Now there's a bit of debate here as to exactly what it's meant by this. So it starts out by talking about someone who's been castrated, and goes on, someone who's at illegitimate birth, Ammonites and Moabites. So various people either with physical deformities or with who are from these enemy peoples can't enter the assembly of the Lord. So it's a little bit of a question here as to what is meant by the assembly, because that particular Hebrew word can mean a lot of different things. Sometimes it's translated as the congregation. And sometimes people get the impression that this is talking about like the tabernacle. They can't go to the tabernacle or the temple. And I'm not so sure that that's the case, that this is what it's talking about. It's a very good chance that this is talking about they can't be part of a ruling assembly. So it doesn't mean that they ne can't necessarily be part, can't be on the land of Israel, or are restricted from certain other kinds of activities or places. But the assembly here very well could be like a ruling assembly of Israel. So there's, they're in various kinds of cultures. The Greek culture, for instance, in the Greek polis, in the Greek city, there were only certain people who could be elected to office and serve in a ruling capacity, or in some kind of group that was responsible for maintaining the laws of the city. And something like this might be going on here with these first few verses of 23. But anyway, that's kind of what these verses are talking about. So there's certain restrictions about who's in and who's out with regard to this assembly of the Lord. And you can see how the history of Israel and their connection to the Ammonites and the Moabites, as well as the Edomites, I mean, that history continued to influence them into the future. Verse 9, we shift focus a little bit to, so you've got Israel, they're going out to do battle. They're gonna confront a foreign army. And that's what these verses 9 and the next few verses are talking about. So it's basically setting up the Israelite army camp as a place where the restrict where like the ritual restrictions aren't nearly as precise as those at the tabernacle, but there it is still understood that in this Israelite army camp that God is dwelling in the midst of them. That's what it says in verse 14. It says, "The Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to defeat your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy. So even in an army camp where you'd expect, you know, standards to be relaxed somewhat, there's an understanding that the Israelites who are there are sort of in a priestly capacity, and just in the sense that they are the chosen ones of the Lord to carry out his will, his martial will, in relation to those enemies that they're going against. And so he says, you shall keep yourself free from every evil thing in verse 9. So don't pollute yourself. And it talks about how if a man has a nocturnal emission, then he's unclean. He has to go outside the camp and cleanse himself and come back into the camp. And we've discussed that elsewhere in the book of Leviticus. So it even gets into details about, like, you got to have an outhouse. You can't just go anywhere you want to. So the basic idea is that God is in the camp. The camp is to be holy. And so there's sort of a sanctification of the military aspect of Israel as well, because God doesn't just stay at the temple or tabernacle and send out his soldiers. He goes with them. He journeys with them. And there's a very real possibility that when it talks about God, like, walking in the midst of the camp, what it's talking about is the Ark of the Covenant is there, because the Ark was carried out quite a few times on military expeditions. So it's the sanctification of the army camp is what those few verses are talking about. Verse 15 and following talks about how you are to treat an escaped slave, that you don't return him to his master, but instead you welcome him, you take care of him. And verses 17 and 18 are discussing a pretty obvious prohibition that if you have a daughter, you don't sell her into cult prostitution, or if you have a son, that you don't sell him into cult prostitution, because, of course, this was practiced by the nations which were around Israel. And as it says here, that was an abomination to the Lord. Now, this is interesting. Just a little side note here on an irony. So verse 18 says that if you have money from the hire of a harlot, then you don't bring that money into the Lord's house as some sort of offering to him, because, of course, those things are an abomination to the Lord. So the basic idea is that if you've got money from something evil, you don't turn around and put that in the offering plate. Okay. Now, the reason I think this is ironic is because think of what happened in the case of Judas. So Judas gets money from the priest to betray Jesus. And then after he betrays Jesus, he feels bad about it. And so he returns the money. And I'm trying to find my New Testament reference here. Maybe you know it off the, maybe you know it off the top of your head. It's Matthew 27:6. Let me read you what the priests say. This is the great irony of their reflection of this Old Testament law. So Judas goes back, and he feels remorse. He goes back to take the 30 pieces of silver back to the chief priest and says, "I've sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they say, "What is that to us? See to that yourself." He throws the pieces of silver down, walks away, and commits suicide. And here's what the chief priests say about the silver. "It's not lawful to put them," that is the silver, "into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood." And so they have a meeting, and they decide instead they're going to use it to buy the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Just a blatant case of hypocrisy, where they had given him the money to do this. They had provided the blood money, but they won't take it back because they're too observant of the law to take this blood money and put it back in the temple treasury, even though they're the very ones who provided it to Judas. What an obvious case of how the law can be twisted to where it looks like, oh, you're being oh so pious and keeping it, and actually you're engaging in this blatant hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, what happened here with the priest.
I do think this is interesting that you have this law telling you not to return slaves to their masters, which tells you that God knows that the sort of slavery that we hear about in Israel is not like the slavery of other nations. So much so, you know, where it's just you own these people and you're cruel and all this stuff is going on. So much so that if someone from another nation escapes, or just a mistreated person escapes, you don't give him back. And it says actually that you should not do him any wrong.
Yeah, I think it goes to the heart of Israel's ongoing admonition to welcome the stranger, right? Mm-hmm. To take care of the sojourner, not to mistreat them. I think people sometimes get the impression the Old Testament is like Israel good, everybody else bad. Well, that doesn't hold true at all with what we've been reading in Deuteronomy and elsewhere, where there's an ongoing encouragement, in fact, law by God to welcome the stranger. If somebody is, they're not an Israelite, but they're living in the midst of Israel, then you welcome them. I mean, there's even laws in which they can participate in the Passover. So there's certainly a more open-armed approach on the part of Israel that sometimes people have an impression of Israel's openness. So there's not kind of a xenophobia that characterizes Israel. They had their borders were porous, and so people were passing in and out and trading and evidently escaping from slavery sometimes. And we have plenty of instances in the Old Testament where people from other nations were actually in the high reaches of government or the military. Think of Uriah, right? The husband of Bathsheba. Uriah was one of David's closest friends. He was in David's inner circle, and yet Uriah was not an Israelite. He was a Hittite.
Yeah.
So, he obviously lived right beside David's palace, because that's the only way that David would have been able to see Bathsheba bathing, is if, you know, she was right there close to the palace. So the very proximity of this Hittite's house to David's palace tells you that he was an important person, yet he was not an Israelite.
Well, think about the reputation that Israel must have for slaves to want to escape there.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, we know where we can go and be safe. Yeah, go to Israel.
Yeah, you don't escape to Israel's horrible. They treat people terribly. Let's go escape there. You know, so I mean, this seems like a destination that you would go to if you were, you know, it's probably like back in the day, if you were in the South, you escape North.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. you don't run further South.
And chances are that the word about Israel would have spread to people who were looking to escape and looking for a place to go. Go to Israel, because even their God has said that they must welcome us and take care of us.
Yeah, and they're not allowed to mistreat us.
The natural fear of an escaped slave would be if he goes somewhere, then he's just going to be enslaved again.
Right.
He seeks protection somewhere, and they welcome him in, but they welcome him in just to shackle him once more into more slavery. All right, so wrapping up the chapter here, the next few verses talk about If you loan money to a fellow Israelite, you can't charge them interest. So you could loaning was encouraged. It was understood it was going to happen. But if you do that, then you can't charge interest to your fellow Israelite. You can to a foreigner. So maybe there were Israelites that were loaning money to people who were outside of Israel, and they could do that. And they could charge them interest, but not to their own countrymen. And then verse 21 through 23 says more or less, if you take a vow, then you keep that vow. You can't like take a vow and then the next day be like, oh man, why did I say that? I'm going to take it back. Whatever you vowed, then God calls you to be obedient and faithful to that which you have promised. And then the chapter ends up 24 and 25. These subjects like go. I don't know if there's any way I can segue between these. It's like they're all thrown in here. We got everything from sex to offerings to slavery to making vows, and it ends up by throwing something else in there, basically saying, you know, if you go for a walk and you're a little bit hungry, you know, you hadn't had lunch yet, and you're walking through your neighbor's vineyard and you pluck a few grapes, that's fine, you know, pop the grapes in your mouth, eat those grapes, that's fine, but don't like carry a basket with you and fill the basket up with grapes. Don't do that. Because, you know, your neighbor's going to be okay with you plucking a few grapes and having a little snack, but he's not going to be okay if you walk out of his vineyard with a couple of baskets full of his grapes. So, you know, don't be dumb.
Grapes in your mouth is fine. Grapes in your pockets, no.
Yeah, that's the summary of the law. Grapes in your mouth, good. Grapes in your pocket, not. And then we actually have a story that is somewhat reflected in verse 25, where it says, like, if you're, so you're not in your neighbor's vineyard, but you are walking through his wheat field and, you know, you're hungry. You pluck a few heads of grain, you rub them together, and you, I've never actually, it doesn't sound very appetizing to me.
Yeah, this sounds terrible. You got to be really hungry.
I've done that. I mean, I grew up with wheat farmers and I helped them with harvest a few times. And yeah, you can get some of the wheat and, you know, you can put a little bit in your mouth, but it's not a very tasty snack. I mean, you got to kind of grind it up with your teeth and it's dry. And so it's not very appetizing, but I guess if you're hungry, hey, you can do that. So if you do that, same law applies. You can do that, but don't like, hey, I'm going to go for a walk in my neighbor's grain field. I'm going to carry my sickle with me. I'm gonna cut down a few sheaves of wheat and take it back home. What? No, you can't do that. So the New Testament story, of course, you probably recognize it, is when Jesus is with his disciples walking through a grain field. And the disciples are hungry, so they start doing this. The only thing is, it's a Sabbath. And according to the rabbinical law, they were working by rubbing the grain together to get something for a snack. And Jesus, as always, shows them just how wrong they are. Because listen, so you think this is wrong? Have you never read what David did? He went into the tabernacle and he ate the sacred bread, which was only for the priest. So it's kind of an argument from greater to lesser in that case. That's an Old Testament law that we see reflected in one of those New Testament narratives. So that's all of chapter 23. We got about 6 minutes left. So let's jump into the beginning of chapter 24. Now, this is actually a very, very fascinating section, and we'll see if we can cover it right quick. If not, we can touch on it again next week. So here's the situation. This is back to marriage and sex again, although it's more marriage than sex. So if this is about divorce and possible remarriage. So there's a guy who takes a wife, it says, and it says it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes, which is kind of a general term, right? What does that mean? So she's displeasing to him in some way. And then it like gets a little more specific. He says, because he's found some indecency in her. But even that is not very specific. I was doing some research on the Hebrew of that particular phrase, some indecency in her. And it's, even that's pretty ambiguous. I mean, it can mean anything from just like something wrong to maybe she's committed a, you know, a sexual sin or something along those lines. It's used, we saw it actually in chapter 23 when it was talking about, let me find it here. Talking about, since God is in your camp, keep your camp holy so that he doesn't see anything indecent among you. That Hebrew phrase translated in 23:14 about anything indecent, exact same phrase, Hebrew phrase that you have at the beginning of Deuteronomy 24, if he finds something indecent in her. So what does that mean? Well, who knows? But we do know that it was taken a couple different ways by first century rabbis. You had a couple different schools of thought. You had the school of Shammai, those who identified with the rabbi Shammai, and they interpreted this very narrowly to mean some sort of sexual indecency. So maybe she's committed adultery or something like that. Now, the school of Hillel interpreted this Hebrew phrase, something indecent, very broadly. I mean, anything. So there's just something about her that he doesn't like, whatever that might be. And so the school of Shammai said you could divorce her only on grounds of marital infidelity. The school of Hillel said you could divorce her on the grounds of burning the breakfast or snoring in bed or whatever else you found unpleasing about her. Now, that's really actually not the focus of these opening verses. The focus is, so you've done it. You've divorced her. You've given her what's called a certificate of divorce, and you've put it in her hand, and you've sent her out of your house. So you've divorced You've divorced her. Now, what's she going to do? Well, probably she's going to marry somebody else, because that's usually what happened in this culture. So she goes out, and later she becomes another man's wife. And then, well, what happens if that guy divorces her, or if he dies and now she's a widow? Well, in that case, then she can't remarry her original spouse. So her first husband, who sent her away, is not allowed to take her back, because she has been the wife of another man or of other men. Now, what I find fascinating about this is not so much the whole discussion of divorce and remarriage and all of that in Israel, but take some time and read Jeremiah chapter 3. Because Jeremiah chapter 3 is actually a sermon by God through Jeremiah on Deuteronomy 24. And here's what's fascinating. In the beginning of the chapter of Jeremiah chapter 3, he quotes Deuteronomy 24 and says, okay, here's the situation. But then he relates it to himself, and he says, okay, well, you know what? I had a wife. Her name was Israel. And you know what she did? Well, she whored under every green tree she could find. She was sleeping with every god. She was committing spiritual adultery all over the place. I mean, she had this whole string of divine husbands that she was worshiping. And yet, he goes on to say, and yet, if she comes to me, I'll take her back, because I'm merciful and I'm compassionate. So God, as it were, quote, breaks his own law, in the sense that he lets love triumphs over judgment, and his mercy always wins in the end. So to Israel, he says, I'll take you back, just like Hosea took back Gomer. And just like we have God always calling us back to himself. So even though this might have been a law in Israel, and who knows how closely it was kept, when in God's relationship with his church and with Israel, he's the husband who is constantly calling his unfaithful bride back to himself, because he's a God of mercy and compassion.
Yeah, there's two things that makes me think of. One is that this law probably does have to do with sexual infidelity, since that's the way that is used in Jeremiah. This seems like it would be a good argument for that. That's what it means by find something, whatever, displeasing or dishonoring. And secondly, that God is. There's a lot of times in the Bible where you see God do things that. I mean, how often does Jesus get accused of breaking the law?
I know
we talk about this, like Jesus without sin and all that, and like, it certainly he was, because love is the heart of the law. So people are using the letter of the law to try to override the heart of the law. But on the surface, it certainly looks like Jesus just breaks the law all the time.
Yeah, he touches a leper.
Yeah, right. You can't do that. Like, there's no way around the fact that, like, that is not allowed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, I find it fascinating. And the reason I brought in Jeremiah 3 is because it's not just like a Jesus thing. You already see this happening in the Old Testament, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, where God says, okay, here's the law, and now watch what I do, you know? So you already have this precedent in the Old Testament where, yeah, you got the letter law, but watch how God interacts with Israel. It's pretty fascinating. Not only is Israel like married again, but she like married 50 different gods, and Yahweh's still like, come back to me.
Yeah.
I love you. I'll forgive you.
Yeah, and whenever you see this stuff happen, this law breaking, this quote, I'm doing air quotes right now, this quote law breaking happening with God or with Christ or whatever it is, what you will see is a common theme is it's always for the sake of compassion and love and mercy and forgiveness, which tells you that like where the priorities are with God.
Yeah.
Which is a real good thing.
It is a real good thing. It's a great way to end too.
That's it. All right, guys, if you enjoy the podcast and would like to support the work, go over to 1517.org, go to the donate page. You can become a contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. You make this all possible. Chad, I'll see you next week.
See you then.